CBS News Summary and News Analysis. A summary of the latest developments of the war and home fronts by John Daly, followed by an analysis by Robert Trout. The news highlights. Sudden death of President Roosevelt shocks world. Allied leaders pay tribute to President. Vice President Truman, sworn in as President, pledges prosecution of war to successful conclusion. Ninth Army crosses Elba River, moves ahead on road toward Berlin. Japanese flyers make suicide attacks on Okinawa. Now, here is John Daly, editor for CBS World News.
Tonight, Vice President Harry S. Truman took the oath of office as the 32nd President of the United States 2 hours and 34 minutes after the death of Franklin D. Roosevelt in his 63rd year at his home in Warm Springs, Georgia. President Truman immediately made it clear that he will carry out President Roosevelt's policies. A terribly shocked nation, a grieved allied world, is pouring out its sympathy, its regret, its unbelievable astonishment. It's belief that the accomplishments of Franklin Roosevelt, his aims for a better world, will be carried on. The president died in harness, still working for the better world he hoped to help shape. At Warm Springs, he got down to work about noon today. He signed routine documents, awards for war heroes, State Department appointments, and a long list of postmaster nominations. Meanwhile, as he sat in front of his fireplace, he posed for a portrait artist. The president's last official act was to sign legislation extending the life of the Commodity Credit Corporation. And with it, as usual, he had a joke. He who made more laws than any other president told White House Secretary William Hassett, "Here's where I make a law." Hassett left the room. It was 1 o'clock. Suddenly the president said, "I have a terrific headache," his last words. A few minutes later, he fainted. His Negro valet and the Filipino mess boy carried him to his bedroom. At 4:35 p.m. Eastern wartime, the president died, without pain, without having regained consciousness. Secretary Hassett met correspondents in a white cottage near the Warm Springs administration building and told them, "It is my sad duty to inform you that the president died of a cerebral hemorrhage." And at 5:45 p.m. Eastern wartime in Washington, former press secretary Steve Early told the correspondents there of the president's death. Mrs. Roosevelt was in Washington at a thrift club meeting. Mr. Early called the club and asked her to return to the White House as soon as possible. Mr. Early and Admiral McIntyre went with her into a sitting room, and they told her that the president had slipped away. After her daughter, Mrs. John Berger, had been informed, Mrs. Roosevelt sent messages to her 4 sons, James, Elliot, Franklin Jr., and John, all of them in service. The message said, "He slept away this afternoon. He did his job to the end, as he would want to do. Bless you all and all our love. Signed, Mother." For the public, Mrs. Roosevelt said, "I am more sorry for the people of the country and the world than I am for us." Mr. Truman was working at his desk when he received a call about 5:25 p.m. Eastern wartime. A few minutes later, Secret Service men arrived at his office and whisked him to the White House. Mr. Truman was ushered to Mrs. Roosevelt. She told him the president had passed away. "What can I do?" asked Mr. Truman. Mrs. Roosevelt said, "Tell us what we can do. Is there any way we can help you?" Mr. Truman called the cabinet to the White House. Through Mr. Early, he issued a statement saying that he wanted the cabinet to stay on with him, that it would be his first effort to carry on as he believes President Roosevelt would have done. At 7:09 p.m. Eastern wartime, Vice President Truman, reading the oath of office from a slip of paper as Chief Justice Stone administered it from memory, became the 32nd President of the United States. He shook hands with dignitaries all around him, many of them with handkerchiefs at their faces. President Truman issued a one-sentence statement. It said, "The world may be sure that we will prosecute the war on both fronts, east and west, with all the vigor we possess to a successful conclusion." President Roosevelt, or rather President Truman, 11 years ago, a Missouri County judge, made it clear that the United Nations San Francisco conference, which Mr. Roosevelt was to have addressed, will open on schedule. And then he, his wife and daughter, went to talk again with Mrs. Roosevelt before going home. Mr. Roosevelt's body will arrive in Washington on Saturday. Funeral services will be held in the afternoon in the East Room of the White House. Burial will be in the family plot at Hyde Park, New York, on Sunday afternoon. The funeral is expected to be as private as possible. Tonight, CBS correspondents and analysts at home and abroad have been bringing you the shock reactions to the president's death from all over the world. The news reached General Eisenhower while he was conferring in the field with his officers. The American broadcasting station in London made what it called a bitter announcement. The news was flashed to our troops in the field, followed by the Star-Spangled Banner. The British radio told its listeners it was the president who, in the grim days of Dunkirk, shipped us supplies to ward off what he had already seen as a great danger. King George was awakened. Prime Minister Churchill was too shocked to comment. Out in the Pacific, CBS correspondent Don Pryor broadcast the news over Admiral Turner's flagship off Okinawa. Later, he passed on comments of our fighting men. "It's like somebody dying in your own family," said one. And said Admiral Turner, "He is as much a battle casualty as anyone who loses his life out here." The announcement of the president's death came soon after our top army officials and Germany's chief propagandist acknowledged that the war in Germany, which the president had fought so hard, would come to an end very soon. The Senate Military Affairs Committee heard our high army officials express a belief that organized fighting may end probably within a few days. They said a collapse of the German army is imminent, only pockets of resistance will remain to be cleaned out. And so certain are they that drastic reductions have been ordered in the shipment of durable equipment to Europe in preparation for reversing the flow toward the Pacific. Meanwhile, Nazi propagandist Goebbels conceded that the war cannot last much longer. Inside Germany, the American Ninth Army has crossed the Elbe River on a 6-mile front in the Magdeburg area. Details are practically nil, but we're told the Ninth Armored Columns are waiting for what one correspondent with them calls the signal that would send them to Berlin. The Ninth is believed to be 57 miles from Berlin's outskirts, 75 miles from its black, battered heart. Two other American armies, the First and Third, are now moving together, wheel hub to wheel hub, bumper to bumper. They're both closing in on Leipzig, were last reported 23 miles away. To the far north, the British have moved within 45 miles of Hamburg as the Canadians cut 22 miles into the center of the Holland Trap. In the south, the American 7th Army has captured the much-battered ball-bearing center of Schweinfurt, and the French 1st Army seized the Black Forest city of Baden-Baden. On the Eastern European front, Red Army tank columns have cut Vienna's last lifelines to the north and left only a 7-mile escape gap for the city's defenders. Presumably, that gap is now under withering artillery fire. Russian Marines have been landed from gunboats behind the German garrison as other Soviet troops captured 60 blocks in bitter house-to-house fighting on the enemy's island of resistance between the Danube River and its canal. Northeast of Vienna, the 2nd Ukrainian Army has crossed the Moravian frontier and invaded Germany's last great war arsenal. In the Pacific, Japanese planes made another desperate attack on American naval and ground forces in the Okinawa area, 325 miles southwest of Japan proper. They lost 118 planes, but sank one destroyer and damaged several other surface units. Our Marines continue to make progress to the north in the fighting on the island, while Army infantrymen to the south again could report no change in their lines above the capital city of Naha. In Washington, the State and War Departments took formal note of the inhumane treatment American prisoners are receiving from Germany. The joint statement said, "Instances are being daily uncovered of deliberate neglect, indifference, and cruelty, actions which have shocked the entire civilized world. These atrocities," the statement went on, "are documented by the pitiable condition of liberated American soldiers. The American nation will not forget them. The perpetrators of these heinous crimes will be brought to justice." Although the statement did not say so, it's learned at the War Department that we're going to tighten up at various prisoner of war camps in this country. But spokesmen make it clear that this country will not follow Nazi example. We will stick to the conventions of humane treatment of war prisoners. And that's the latest development on German treatment of prisoners. Correspondents who were with President Roosevelt at Warm Springs now have been permitted to tell us of his last news conference. It happened last Thursday when the president met with President Sergei Osmena of the Philippines. The president spoke of his great desire to grant the islands full independence by autumn. Mr. Roosevelt outlined ambitious plans for American participation in the Western Pacific. He said he was determined to prevent further Japanese aggression. And he said this country and the other United Nations must accept trusteeships over Jap-mandated islands. This would be necessary, President Roosevelt added, to build new naval and air bases to help the Philippines rebuild economically after the Commonwealth becomes a self-governing nation. This news was to have been released only after the president returned to Washington. Now, it becomes the first of many reports that we may expect to hear of Mr. Roosevelt's desires for the world.
You've been listening to John Daly, one of Columbia's news editors. Each night at this time, CBS World News presents an analysis of the latest news developments. Tonight, Robert Trout.
It would be very difficult to analyze the news in the usual fashion tonight. The tragic news from Warm Springs has stunned the world so with its shocking suddenness that nations and the men and women who make up the nations must take time to catch their breath. The tributes are pouring out of the world's important cities and into Washington. There are millions everywhere from whom no words are expected, millions whose names are not newsworthy and whose tribute of sorrow will be given in silence away from the glare of public events. Those whose position makes fitting a public expression have found the words or are finding them tonight. The shock has been sudden, but it is possible now to find the right words to say. There has been time to think of what the president's death means tonight, but there has not been time to think what it will mean in the days ahead. Franklin Roosevelt was a battle casualty. He died during the war, and he died in the war. Even had he been spared to witness the great victory to which he has given so much, his death after the last shot had been fired would still have been a war death, for he did give much of himself. He contributed immeasurably to the triumph that is coming, and in doing so, he gave the most that any man can give. Most battle casualties are sudden. They leave a space which seems particularly tragic because it was unforeseen. It's human nature among the great and famous, as well as the unknown, to avoid considering a terrible loss that may happen as long as there is a reasonable chance that it will not. It would be too much to expect that the president's colleagues among the Allied nations, such men as Winston Churchill or Joseph Stalin, have planned the actions they must take or have thought long and consistently of what the death of Franklin Roosevelt will mean. And it would be equally unwise to fear that now that the blow has come, the responsible men will find it difficult to meet the situation that results from the loss of one of the key architects of victory and what is to come after victory. The Allied nations are strong, and the Allied power comes from many sources, but most of all from the millions who were plunged into mourning late this afternoon. The pause that has come is an interval necessary when the mind has been shocked and the breath must be caught. There has not been time to think. The news is known, but the brain does not quite grasp it. There is the knowledge that in the days to come, the loss will be felt often at various turns in the road. The mind knows that, for that is the way of death. But the mind does not wish to consider it in all its implications, not yet. From strange countries far away and from our closer allies and from the cities of our own United States, the news tonight is the same. Everywhere, men at first say, "No, it is not true. I do not believe it. It could not happen now, not now." That is the thought of men who drive taxicabs and who sit in offices and teach in classrooms and farm the earth. It is the thought, too, of reporters who are supposed to be toughened against news of disaster and pain. There are many reporters who've been writing and speaking this news for more than 5 hours now who've not had the leisure in which to stop and think. When this night's work has been done, to many the notion will come, it has not happened, it cannot be true. The thoughts and feelings of reporters are not so different from the mental processes of men who drive the taxicabs and the women who cook in kitchens. The minds of statesmen and generals also react in a similar fashion when confronted with tragedy. It would be too much, then, to expect the men who are now responsible for the victory and what will come after the victory to think deeply tonight of the meaning of April the 12th, 1945. And it would be too little to expect anything less than that the victorious alliance will roll on in war and in peace, on the battlefield and at San Francisco and the conference rooms. For a great man is dead, but the strength of the millions who mourn is enduring. Good night.
That was Robert Trout. You've been listening to CBS News Summary and News Analysis. This month, the American people are being asked to contribute clothing to help millions of the war-impoverished people of Europe. It's the largest campaign of its kind in history. a measure of the urgent need for relief overseas. You are urged to collect the old clothing that you no longer need yourself, to give it to the millions who face possible death from exposure in the months ahead. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.